if we assume that everybody is going to come up to the highest quality of life, then CO2 emissions, which are at about 50 billion tons per year, by the back end of this century, that's going to double. If we let that happen, you know, without doing anything about it, and if we keep on burning fossil fuels throughout the next century, then you're going to be reaching 10 degrees plus temperature increase, you know, which puts us back, you know, 60, 70 million years ago with a climate which is better suited to dinosaurs than it is to humans.
Welcome to another episode of the ESG Factor podcast. I'm Vincent McCarthy, and today I'm chatting with Matthew Hampshire-Waugh, author of Climate Change and the Road to Net Zero. Matthew, great to have you on the podcast. I'm enjoying your book. It's interesting. It's making the subject much more accessible to people, which I like. Can you maybe give listeners a snapshot of your own journey up to this point to writing this book?
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on the podcast. My background's actually in science. So I did my undergraduate in chemistry, University of Bristol. Finished up in the mid 2000s. Didn't quite know what I wanted to do, so took a year out, went to the French Alps, and did a ski season running a bar. Came back to the UK and decided that I hadn't had enough of science. I wanted to go further. Applied for a couple of PhDs and ended up at University College London, working on a project in sort of energy efficiency. And so we were looking at designing new materials, new coatings for windows in buildings, which essentially mimic the greenhouse effect. So they let in the sun's visible light. It heats the room. The infrared radiation is re-radiated, but it gets trapped in the room by this coating. So it's kind of a passive heating mechanism to boost the efficiency of buildings. And so we were working on this. And at the time, I was actually reading a book called The Fountains of Paradise by Arthur C. Clarke. And in this book, there's this engineer in the year 2200, and he builds an elevator into space. And I was just taken with this idea. And there was actually a project at the time looking at actually building this thing. And there was one material on Earth which is strong enough and light enough to actually create an elevator into space. And this was carbon nanotubes. So very small tubes of carbon, about a millionth of a millimeter wide. And you'd basically make a big ribbon out of these things, attach it to the equator, and have the other end in geosynchronous orbit spinning with the Earth. And so you can shuttle spaceships up and down without burning any fuel. And so I decided I had to get into this, and I set up the lab equipment, and we started growing these things and looking at the properties and trying to integrate them into everything from, you know, these window applications, flexible touchscreen displays, right through to solar panels. We're trying to boost the efficiency of solar panels. So really, my science background and PhD, this is where my passion for energy efficiency and these net zero technologies really started.
It sounds a bit like an episode of Rick and Morty. Have you ever watched that show?
No.
Yeah, the mad scientist. So you went from your science, and then you went into investment banking, which is an interesting leap. You went into Credit Suisse. You're working in their research department.
I was, yeah. So a bit of a leap, and probably the quote that sums it up best. I think it's Thomas Edison, the sort of father of electricity. He put, innovation is 1,000 ways of figuring out how not to do something. And that's very apt for science as well, because you're not going to the lab every day and coming up with some eureka discovery. It's about grinding it out and small incremental progress. And after sort of 7 years of doing that, I felt like I needed something a bit more fast paced, a bit more direct. And so I ended up, in finance and at an investment bank at Credit Suisse, covering chemicals companies. And so I worked in equity research, and for anyone who's listening and not in finance, equity research is basically, I was covering chemicals companies, which means I would look at their markets, look at their technology, and try and forecast out their future cash flows and put a value on the business. And then once you got a value on the business, you can figure out what the shares are worth. And I would publish reports and take them around investors across the UK, across Europe, the US, and advise pension funds and hedge funds whether they should be buying or selling the shares in these companies. And I carried the interest in sort of energy efficiency and new energy technologies through to my work at Credit Suisse by covering these chemical companies which were doing really interesting things in the new energy supply chain. So companies making enzymes for bioethanol or polysilicon to go into solar panels or battery materials which would end up in the batteries of electric cars. And so, I was covering all these companies and trying to build out a knowledge base there. And actually, this is sort of, I think any career you're in, you always have to craft a sort of niche as to, where you can add value. And, there's all this amazing sort of specialized work out there. But I felt that nobody was stitching it together and integrating it in a sort of holistic way. And so I took it upon myself to start collecting basically analysts from all over this global bank in all areas of these supply chains and just collecting up their knowledge, their forecasts, their modeling, and stitching it all together and sort of putting together these big integrated assessment models and reports on different supply chains. And that became really what I was really interested in at Credit Suisse.
And electric vehicles was a big part of that as well. You produced some research on that, which you tried to bring across different firms as well.
Yeah, so actually one of the reports which really garnered a lot of attention was, I think it was in the back end of 2015, just after the VW scandal, and there's been this big backlash against sort of combustion engines and particularly diesel. But at the same time, I could see this kind of triangulation between innovation coming from Tesla and at the same time a real tightening of legislation on tailpipe emissions for cars was coming across Europe and China in the coming years from the 2020s. And I just felt like this, this triangulation of pressure points on the industry was going to really be a tipping point for change. And so we put together across the bank, a big report all the way from metal and mining, it could be cobalt or lithium, all the way through to producing electric vehicles and autonomous driving software and everything in between. And we could flex scenarios, and we're trying to figure out when's oil going to peak, what's electric vehicle penetration going to look like in 2025 or 2040. We published this big report. We put it out there. We were marketing it across, across London, across Europe, and great take up from investors. It's, great reports, really detailed, but it's not going to happen, was kind of the response. Electric cars, they've had so many false starts, this is going to be another one. We're a little bit disheartened, but I remember sort of 6 to 12 months later, we ploughed on with it. And Tesla was really making waves at that time, and all of a sudden it just hit this tipping point, and everybody wanted to know about all of this electric car and electric vehicle supply chain. And suddenly we had this model, and we could flex whatever scenario you wanted, and we could tell you the outcome for oil demand, electricity demand, electric cars, what type of metal and mining firms are going to benefit, what type of battery material technology is going to come through. And so we had this amazing resource just at the right time when everyone was becoming interested in this. And that really sort of set it in stone for me that, this is a niche that I want to fill, is pulling together all this amazing specialized work that people do and stitching it all together in a big picture.
Yeah, and I think that point that you make around the tipping point is crucial, because I think at an overarching level in terms of sustainability, responsible investment, the last couple of years you've really seen that the momentum has gathered. And I suppose that reflects the challenges that we have within our economic system and, most importantly, the climate crisis. So you left Credit Suisse and you started writing this book, Climate Change and the Road to Net Zero. And reading your book, what I like about it is it does bring the subject to life, because some of the books on climate change can be very scientific, and I think it's about making this subject much more accessible to people. So you talk about your protagonist in your story is carbon dioxide, CO2, and you paint a nice story of kind of the history of the planet and modern human history, and this very, very short period of 200 years since the Industrial Revolution, when we mastered combustion, as you said, all of a sudden prosperity shot up for a certain percentage of the population, but at the same time, CO2 shot up. So can you maybe give people a little bit of a snapshot for people that don't really understand the specifics of climate change or greenhouse gas emissions, carbon dioxide, the implications of what this all means for all of us living on this planet?
Yeah, so I mean, as you say, I've tried to build a sort of narrative in the book, and it's kind of exploring the sort of two ends of the climate divide, if you like. So, it's a narrative of how the Industrial Revolution has freed humanity from what's called the Malthusian trap, which was this, Robert Malthus was this 18th century scholar who basically said every time we improve productivity, human population increases faster, there's more mouths to feed, and your quality of life for humans is going to be at this constant level forever. And actually, if you look at look back through thousands of years of the economic data, Angus Maddison has done a lot of work on this. Then you look at GDP per capita has been stuck for most of human history at about $1,000 per person. So humans were stuck in this poverty trap for a long time, up until 200 years ago, as you say, and we mastered combustion of fossil fuels, the Industrial Revolution, and now the average GDP per capita is now $18,000 per person per year. And so we've broken free from that poverty trap, but at the same time, as a species, we've irreversibly changed the world. So we've rewritten the rules of evolution. We've brought together once distinct species, diseases, genetic engineering. We're repurposing the Earth's resources through mining and chemical transformation, and now we're starting to re-engineer the climate. And so, to give you an idea of if we took a baseline of inaction, and this is not reflective of what's happening at the moment, because there is change being made, but if we simply said, let's take today and let's make no further effort to decarbonize the economy, but we need to assume that the world is going to come up to the highest standards of living. And the population is going to grow from where it is today at about 8 billion people to about 10 billion people. Then CO2 emissions, which are at about 50 billion tons per year of carbon dioxide equivalent today, by the back end of this century, that's going to be at over 100 billion tons. It's going to double. And if we let that happen, without doing anything about it, then we're going to lock in at least 3.5 degrees warming this century. And once the Earth plays catch up, that'll be 5 degrees. And if we keep on burning fossil fuels throughout the next century, then you're going to be reaching 10 degrees plus temperature increase, which puts us back, 60, 70 million years ago with a climate which is better suited to dinosaurs than it is to humans. So it's quite amazing how quickly that we are pumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And, we're doing it faster than any event in the last 66 million years.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's challenging for people is that they hear different numbers being thrown out. So, for instance, you mentioned different degrees in terms of temperature rises. We're looking to limit it to 1.5 degrees. We've pretty much locked that in. Now, a degree and a half, people in Ireland might say I could do with a few more degrees, the weather's not great, okay? But a degree and a half has massive implications for our ecosystem in terms of the species living on this planet. I think a good example is that if your temperature rises by a degree, you've got full-blown fever. So that's kind of the way it is with the planet, isn't it? So we're kind of already in the feverish state, and if we continue on this trajectory, we pass further tipping points where we may not be able to return to a healthy state. That's the real challenge.
Yeah, exactly. And the way I think about it is manageable versus unmanageable change. So, you know, manageable change is the stuff that we can model, that we can, you know, we're not going to get exactly right, but we've got a sort of finger in the air idea of what's going to happen. So, for instance, you know, if we take our baseline of inaction and we've got roughly 3.5 degrees warming by the end of this century, then you can look at the impact that that's going to have on, for instance, human systems. And so it's going to drive, you know, above about 2 degrees and agricultural yields really start declining. So it's going to create in the back end of this century significant food shortages. As the world gets hotter, it creates water stress. So you get more water runoff, you get more unpredictable rainfall, and that means that the availability of water for both industry, agriculture, and for human needs becomes way more strained. Then you have the impacts of sort of heat on productivity. So outdoor labor takes a hit. And then you have the classic impacts that you think about with climate change, you know, the extreme weather, the natural disasters, and the slowly rising sea level, which all creates flooding and infrastructure damage. And so if you start adding all of this up, you know, in terms of people impacted by climate change, you know, in an unchecked scenario, it's probably half the world becomes impacted. Then you start thinking, well, this is the manageable change. What about the unmanageable change? So there are all sorts of tipping points, both within the physical Earth system, as well as in the sort of socio-economic systems of the world, where you can just get rapidly accelerating change and suddenly our model's blown up and everything's way worse than we thought.
If you go back to 1990, which you've referenced in your book, the International Panel on Climate Change was formed, but we've emitted as much CO2 into the atmosphere as all of human activity before. So we've pretty much failed in previous decades, even though we knew the problem was there. Now we've got more momentum behind people looking for change. You're saying that net zero is a real solution to put us on a different path. Can you maybe explain that for people and what it actually means? Because it's just another term for a lot of people.
Net zero is basically reaching a balance between human emissions into the atmosphere and pulling human emissions of greenhouse gases back out of the atmosphere. In reality, the sort of least cost route and route of least resistance is going to be reducing those emissions in the first place as much as we can. And then the hard to abate, you know, the hard to get rid of emissions, which come from certain industries like steel making or cement or aviation, where the solutions aren't cost effective to eliminate the emissions, it may be that we just offset them using something like direct air capture, or more simply just by planting trees. So a growing tree sequesters and takes in CO2 from the atmosphere and locks it away in its trunk and in its roots and in the soils. And that's a very cheap, a very low risk and a very effective way of eliminating and offsetting part of those emissions. But to paint you a sort of a scenario of the transition to net zero, we're going to have to shift to an energy supply which is based largely around renewables, at least over the coming decades and the rest of this century. And that means effectively wind electricity and solar electricity. And you're going to have to couple that with short-term storage, things like lithium-ion batteries or pumped hydro, so the reservoirs of water with a generator. And that's going to form, you know, that's going to give you dispatchable renewable energy. So even if the wind's not blowing or the sun's not shining at various points in through the day or through the year, you're going to have this electricity stored and it's going to be ready to go at all times. And you know, because we're going to have to shift our energy supply to wind and solar and electricity, then we're going to have to change our demand to use electricity. So we're going to have to essentially electrify everything. And what does that mean in practice? Well, that means that you're going to have to switch to an electric car, heat your house with an electric heat pump instead of a gas boiler, use an electric cooker. Industry is going to have to use electric heating instead of burning coal or gas. We need to electrify all aspects of the economy. And then at the same time, agriculture is going to have to change practice as well. So agriculture doesn't use a lot of energy, but it uses a lot of land. And using a lot of land means you have to chop down forests, and that carbon all goes up into the atmosphere. The agricultural system needs to become more efficient. And one of probably the best ways of doing that is for me and you to consume less meat. So to give you a stat, the average human diet uses about a football pitch of land. If you're a vegan, you use just the penalty box.
I remember reading that in the book and I thought, yes, this guy's using some football references. I can relate to that.
I know you like football.
But on the point of net zero, to keep on a football analogy, when Liverpool fans used to always say, well, Liverpool's net spend is zero because we sold Coutinho to Barcelona and we bought Van Dijk and Alisson. So we were like, we won the league without spending any money. And it used to really rattle kind of fans of other clubs, you know. But the point they were making is, look, you've still gone out and spent 75 million on Van Dijk. You've spent 40, 50 million on Alisson. So you've spent money. So I suppose the idea of net zero is, we're still spending carbon. We're still putting carbon up into the atmosphere. The only real change is that we're offsetting it. So is that enough that we're offsetting it, or do we need to go further where we actually start moving into territory where we're putting a lot less in and taking more out?
So that depends on the trajectory of how quickly we do things, of how quickly we can transition. So, you know, first and foremost, we need to be reducing the emissions in the first place. And then to reach net zero, we have to be offsetting exactly the amount of emissions that we're still putting into the atmosphere. But if we leave it too long, so we don't act quick enough, then we're, you know, CO2 and greenhouse gases accumulate in the atmosphere. It's kind of like a tap running into a bath, and that bath slowly fills up, and over centuries and millennia it'll draw down, but on human timescales it won't. So if we push too much CO2 into the atmosphere and it accumulates there, then we're going to have locked in warming, and as the Earth's system catches up with that over decades or centuries, that warming is going to keep going. So there's a scenario where if you don't act, but you still want to limit the temperature rise to 1.5 or 2 degrees C to avoid those potential tipping points, then you're actually going to have to draw down carbon from the atmosphere faster than you're putting it there. So it's negative emissions. So you're actually reducing the stock of carbon in the atmosphere and stopping all of that warming coming through. So it really depends on the trajectory that the world takes.
So the economic situation or the economic reasons for not acting is probably what's held us back over previous decades, because people wanted to preserve the status quo. So the case that you're making in your book is that, well, in actual fact, the economics now justify us taking real action and taking real action quickly. So is that enough, do you think, to change the behaviours of the key stakeholders that are part of this economic system that has been created over previous decades? Or do you still think that we're still facing too much pushback between the parties that have benefited most, I suppose, from the prosperity created in previous decades and over the last century?
Yeah, if you look at the economic tipping point, so let's wind back to electric vehicles. So we've now seen announcements over the last 2 years of all the major car makers saying that they're going to be all electric by sort of 2030 or so. So there's been a massive change in that industry, and that's been brought about, as we were talking about, by disruption from Tesla, by regulation, and by the sort of VW scandal and the license to operate, social license to operate. And so you need all of these pressures from individuals, from corporates, from governments. You need all of them to create change. But once you also have the economics aligning, then for me, that bridges that sort of left-right politics climate divide. So it doesn't matter if you're left-leaning, right-leaning politics, big business or small business, whether you're looking at your own self-interest or society, if net zero solutions are cheaper in terms of economics, plus they solve climate change, plus they also solve air pollution, which we haven't even touched on. But you know, most air pollution is actually the second biggest killer in the world. So 8 million out of the 60 or so million people who die every year die from inhaling small particles of carbon from the burning of fossil fuels. So you've got these massive co-benefits of moving to net zero, and it's cheaper. Suddenly everyone's talking from the same hymn book. Suddenly it's not economy versus environment, rich versus poor, present generations versus future generations. Everything's aligned, so we can have our cake and eat it. And I firmly believe that.
But isn't there as well the challenge, I suppose, is that there's such a rush now to be part of this sustainability parade and make these big commitments around net zero. I mean, every company is rushing to publish their net zero targets. Unfortunately, a lot of them are out in the future. So 2050 is the date that is often referenced. And the executive leadership of these companies, or even the political leaders, you know, they're looking 2, 3, 4 years ahead, potentially to the next election, whereas these targets are far out. So the challenge for people is understanding what's meaningful. And I suppose that's where we need to see shorter metrics as well, and to see that there's an accountability in terms of these commitments and making sure that we actually are on the right path. Because the last thing we want is arrive at 2030 or 2050 and we've made no changes, and the leadership of the past are either on a sun lounge or somewhere, or pushing up daisies. Because it's quite a bit into the future, even though it's on the grand scale of the planet's history, it's a very short timeline. Yeah. So I suppose that's the most difficult thing for people. And do you have any advice in your book in terms of how they can better understand who's serious about this stuff, in terms of, as you talk about, look, you vote with your ballot paper, who you elect, and you vote with the decisions you make as a consumer and an investor. Is there easy ways for them to kind of wade through some of the noise around this subject?
It is noisy, and it all needs to get better. You know, if you look at, for instance, carbon accounting is basically where financial accounting was 90 years ago after the Wall Street crash, right? We know we need to do it. It's just we don't have all the standards and everything we need in place, and not everybody's aligned, and it's a confusing space. But you know, progress is being made. And I just think that the pressure has to come from all angles. So you as an individual, look, it's very easy to blame government inaction or corporate profiteering for all of the climate problems, but you've got to realize that you can push the system as well. So you know, I've got sort of the three steps that I would push as an individual is to firstly electrify everything. So you know, force the system to using electricity, and then source that electricity from renewable energy suppliers and tariffs, or even better, put solar panels on top of your house. Secondly, reduce meat consumption, because this comes back to the amount of agricultural land used. And you know, to give you another stat, if everybody went vegan on the planet, you could plant forests in the area of land that was freed up from cattle grazing, and we could sequester all of the emissions that humans have ever put back into the atmosphere. And so it's a really powerful Coming into this, before I'd done the numbers, I was a bit skeptical of going vegetarian or vegan. Does it really help? It's actually a very, very powerful tool for helping the planet. And broadly, to get to net zero, big meat-eating countries like Europe, US, Latin America, Australia need to roughly halve meat consumption so that the rest of the world can increase protein consumption. So, 3 days a week, me and my family just eat veggie. It's simple changes like this. And I'm a firm believer in none of this should be, it should not be a hardship, right? So, driving an electric car, I drive an electric car, it's way better than a combustion engine. I have solar panels on my roof, I don't have to do anything. A little bit of hassle getting them installed, but then they just sit there for 30 years. So there are all of these changes that you can do as an individual. And as you say, the third route is to vote with your ballot paper. So you've got to figure out who are the credible green politicians and vote with your wallet. So buy green aligned products. So that, as soon as corporations see their revenue lines and their profits going down, they're going to quickly sort of turn course and start getting on board the sustainable revolution. So you have a role as an individual, but you can't, we're all going to be climate hypocrites. We can't all live off grid in a zero carbon lifestyle. So then, it is up to corporates as well to provide us with the options, the green options and the low carbon options to consume in terms of goods and services, and not to not to greenwash, but to be genuinely backing that. And it is up to governments to create and facilitate system change, so that they, they make it easy for more renewables to come onto the grid. So they, they make it easy for agriculture to change, and they're putting in place all the processes which are required to regulate this stuff and to monitor it and to communicate it with us. So change needs to come from everywhere.
Yeah, I think that's the point. I think the big factor that I've been focused on is trying to increase awareness around the subject, because the more informed people are, the better chance that they'll make more informed decisions. I guess that's what we want to see. And I think it's interesting as well on your point around hardship, and the challenge is that for a lot of people living in the world, they live in hardship already. So I think it's for the people that, like ourselves in Western society, we might have certain challenges, but in the grand scheme of things, we're relatively well off. And I think what we need to see is that those in the positions of power and responsibility, particularly in the most developed countries, need to look at this, that we need a planetary solution, and those countries are going to have to do a big part of the heavy lifting, I think. And those are the changes we're going to need to see. In terms of your own gut feeling on where this might end, because I know you start your book and you say this story is not fully written, or it's an unwritten story. Are you confident? Because you kind of have there's kind of mixed messages. You're very optimistic on one side of things about the momentum we're seeing recently, and then you obviously see the scale of the challenge. Do you think we face further catastrophe, or are we on a point now that we're on the right trajectory? We've got enough of buy-in from the key stakeholders, and that we continue to see this building momentum at a quicker speed.
So I'm coming back to your inequality point, and that's a great point. To give you a couple of stats, the top 10% wealthiest in the world, and remember, you only need to earn more than $16,000 a year to be in the top 10% wealthiest people in the world. We're responsible for a third of all greenhouse gas emissions. We also take home 50% of global income, and we hold 80% of all the world's wealth. So, to be clear, the onus has to be on the richest parts of the world to lead the way in terms of decarbonisation. And what does that mean? That means that we need to be pushing hardest on all of these net zero technology options while they're still relatively high on the experience curve and still slightly more expensive than the fossil fuel alternative. And we need to scale them up so that it drives the cost down. And actually, once you're about 25%, so a quarter of the way through the transition to 100% net zero, the whole system cost of net zero actually becomes cheaper than the fossil fuel equivalent. So at that point, it becomes, you know, uneconomic, unethical, unimaginable not to be transitioning to net zero for everyone, because it's the best economic option. So that's kind of the job that I see for the rich countries of the world. In terms of, am I positive on change? Well, I think once you hit these economic tipping points, that's when change starts happening very quickly. You know, so, and it's actually interesting, because if you look at energy analyst forecasts and all of this stuff, they've been completely wrong for the last 20 years. They've consistently, and this is governments, this is major energy agencies, this is analysts, predicting how quickly solar panels have been deployed, or how quickly the cost of solar is going to come down. They've always underestimated the rate of change. Every year in, year out, they underestimate it, and they keep underestimating it. And that's because they're used to geology. So they're used to digging fossil fuels out of the ground. Whereas wind and solar is technology, and it's experience curves and learning rates. And that just moves way faster. So you'll hear people talk about, oh, energy transitions take 50 to 100 years to take shape. You know, if you look back from when humans have gone from burning trees to burning coal to burning oil. Yeah, but they're all, you know, that's fossil fuel transitions. This is a technology transition. This can happen much faster. And when you reach, you know, cost parity between net zero and fossil fuels, I think that's where you're starting to hit tipping points. And already, if you look at wind and solar electricity generation, it's comparable, basically, in most areas of the world to fossil fuel, so coal or gas electricity generation. Very soon, you'll be able to add storage to that, and it'll be the same price. Then it'll become cheaper. Because, you know, you're going to get down to a couple of cents per kilowatt hour generation. This stuff's going to get very cheap very quickly. And all it needs to do is just scale up and come down that commercial experience curve. And, you know, if you look at things like, back to our electric vehicle example, if you look at the buying and running costs of an electric car. So an electric car at the moment, you probably have to spend about $10,000 on the battery. Which means it's slightly more expensive to buy and run an electric car, unless you do a hell of a lot of driving, because it's way more efficient when you are actually driving. But within a couple of years, the rate at which lithium ion battery prices are coming down, it's going to be the cheaper option. So we're so close to all of these things on reaching an economic tipping point. And once it's the cheaper option, you know, there's natural adoption to that. And I just think the whole thing's going to move, you know, way faster than we all think, you know. Think about how quickly we went from vinyl records to tapes to CDs to mini discs, which didn't last very long, to streaming and whatnot. This stuff happens very quickly.
True, yeah. I must say it's fascinating talking to you about this subject, because the one thing that does resonate is your passion and enthusiasm for what you do. And I think for all of us, that's what we should be looking for in our own careers. In terms of where people can access your book, or how do they buy it?
Yeah, well, I've got to finish it first. So you've had a sneak preview.
I've had a sneak preview. Yeah.
It's in the last stages of editing and formatting things. So it should be out in the next couple of months. In the meantime, I've set up a blog, so net-zero.blog, where I've got a synopsis on there with a 5-10 minute read of an overview of everything we've been talking about today in the book, and with blog sections of the book talking about all the things we've picked up on. And then you've also got a bookshelf on there, which is all, I'm going to be posting all the most useful sort of resources that I found most helpful in putting it together and writing it over the last 2 years.
Great. Well, we'll include a link when we post the podcast. We'll include a link to that. And what I would say is that, look, there's a lot of information out there, and it is difficult and challenging for people. It's got lots of different things drawing under attention. But what I would say is that you're making the subject a lot more accessible to people, and even the way you break down some of the definitions that can be a bit confusing for people. So we'll be talking soon, and best of luck with everything.
All right, thank you very much for having me.
Cheers for listening to the ESG Factor podcast. If you're interested in a more sustainable future, then check out theesgfactor.com for details on our Patreon community and how you can support the making of more content like this. I'm Vincent, and I'll catch you later.